Hello and welcome to episode 50 of Exploring Environmental History. I'm Jan Oosthoek.
And I'm Sean Karash.
This is a special edition of the podcast, not only because it is the 50th episode, but also because it is guest-hosted by Sean Karash. And Sean is assistant professor in the Department of History at York University in Toronto, Canada. He also produces and hosts his own excellent podcast, entitled Nature's Past.
By the end of the 19th century, Scotland's woodlands were reduced to about 6% of land cover. Over the course of the 20th century, foresters worked to establish timber reserves on the Scottish uplands, creating forests on marginal lands that were not easily adapted to woodland cover following millennia of deforestation. Using a variety of techniques and strategies drawn from modern forestry practices, the Scottish uplands were afforested in the 20th century, tripling the forest cover. The creation of new forests to serve industrial interests, however, altered the ecology of the Scottish uplands and eventually came into conflict with the interests of environmentalists in the late 20th century. This fascinating history of the afforestation of the Scottish uplands is explored in a new book by environmental historian Jan Oosthoek called Conquering the Highlands, A History of the Afforestation of the Scottish Uplands. To learn more about this book, I spoke with Jan Oosthoek.
So, Jan, why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about the origins of this book? How did you come to study the forest history of Scotland, and particularly the afforestation of the Scottish uplands in the 19th and 20th centuries?
Well, I guess the beginnings are a bit romantic because I was on a summer holiday in 1992 with a friend of mine, and we were hiking in the far north of Scotland, and we came upon this loch. Of course, lochs are the Scottish name for lakes, and the water table was really low because of the dry conditions during that summer. And what was visible were hundreds of tree trunks on the dry lake bed. And the question arose was, what happened here? Because there's no trees around today. So what happened to these trees? This is really dramatic. And when I came back from that holiday, I started to read around and found out that these tree trunks are, well, thousands of years old. In actual fact, about 5,000 years old. And they are the remains of a Scottish pine forest that once grew there. And it was killed off by a climate downturn about 5,000 years ago when it got wetter and colder. And the wetter conditions, well, that's something Scots pine cannot stand very well, so it killed the trees off. And it was also the start of peat growth that is now covering large areas of the far north of Scotland, so blanket peat it's called. From there, actually, I got interested in, well, was it entirely natural that this forest disappeared? It turns out it was, but it was the last time that forests were affected by a natural climatic fluctuation before human interference. Afterwards, you see that agriculture comes in and people start to clear woodlands. And it's actually a combination of climate fluctuations and human activity that's causing the long-term decline of the Scottish forests. And what you see is that by the 14th century, the extent of the Scottish forests is very small. Only 6% of the land surface of Scotland was then covered under some type of woodland. And that remained stable until the early 20th century. And that got me really thinking about, okay, what happened during the 20th century? Because there are quite big forests today. And it turned out that during the 20th century, they planted quite a lot of trees. I mean, the forest area rose from about 6% in 1900 to about 18% in 2000. So that's quite a dramatic land change in a short period of time. And that raises all kinds of questions, kind of why suddenly in the 20th century people started to plant forests on this scale. Why didn't it happen earlier, say, during the 18th or 19th century? So that's how I got into the question of the history of afforestation in the 19th and 20th century.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. I mean, I guess listeners, when they're thinking about this landscape, if we're talking about the Scottish uplands, if we can kind of paint a picture of what you see when you're looking at the uplands, this is not a densely forested place, and you've got a nice photograph of these ancient tree remains in Scotland. But as you say, in the 20th century, that history of a largely treeless landscape changed and became a landscape that was much more treed, or the term that you use in the title of the book, afforestation, which I think makes this an unusual environmental history. If we think about North American environmental history, we're often writing stories about the deforestation of the North American landscape. But what is afforestation?
Technically, it means afforestation means the planting of trees or seeding of trees on land that was previously treeless. But in the Scottish context, it's actually slightly different, because a treeless landscape means, I mean, technically it means there were no trees there at all before. Well, in the case of Scotland, there have been trees in the past, but it's a very, very long time ago. You're really talking about hundreds, if not thousands of years.
So in an ancient past.
In the ancient past. So it's not necessarily bringing back the forests that humans recently destroyed. You talk about a process that took thousands of years. But yeah, essentially it's replanting, or it's creating forests in areas where there were no forests at all.
So what initially drew the concern of Scottish landowners to the state of the woodlands in Scotland in the 19th century? And how did that concern ultimately lead to the formation of what was known as the Forestry Commission?
Well, it has actually quite a long prelude to that led to the creation of the Forestry Commission, which started in the, you can really say, 18th century. Of course, there were concerns before that about the extent of the Scottish forests and wood supply, but I'm not going into that. Scottish landowners wished actually to improve their estates at the same time that they wanted to improve the way it looked. They wanted to improve it aesthetically, so they started to import trees from North America and trying them out on the Scottish estates, and see where they could grow, where they couldn't grow, showing them off to their neighbors. Well, look, I have wonderful new trees here. But they also had a wish to make more profit from their estates. And they thought, well, if these trees are successful, I can create forestry plantations and then harvest the forest and sell the wood for a good price off. And during the 19th century, that movement got much stronger, because there was also the feeling that having no wood reserves was a strategic vulnerability. Unfortunately, the government of the day believed in laissez-faire economics and said simply, well, if there are not enough buyers for wood in Britain and in Scotland, you shouldn't do it. So importing is much cheaper. We have a secure wood supply from Scandinavia and the Baltics and later on Canada. So why should we bother about creating it by ourselves? Nevertheless, the seed of forestry policy and a centralized forestry organization had been planted. And the interesting thing is that in the end, the impetus for creating a forestry commission and a forestry policy is the First World War, when Britain was really experiencing severe timber shortages. And it became very clear that they had to do something about it in case there was another war and it would be cut off from woodland resources overseas, because, you know, the German naval blockade was quite effective, you know, the submarine war.
So Scotland can serve as a kind of strategic timber reserve.
That's right. But yes, there were some problems with creating the timber reserve.
Right. So you described at the top here that millennia of climatic change, many thousands of years ago, transformed the Scottish landscape from one that might have been denser in terms of its woodlands to one that was less suitable for forest growth. So what were some of the challenges that foresters faced in the uplands in terms of trying to create a forest on this landscape? And how did the environment limit the capacity of forestry experts to reconstruct the landscape of Scotland?
The problem that the Forestry Commission faced when it came into being in 1919 was that food production became a priority as well after the First World War. And the idea was to make Britain self-sufficient in terms of food production. That meant that forestry only could get the less fertile uplands of Britain, in particularly Scotland, Northern England, and in Wales. The more fertile soils, of course, were reserved for food production. The problem was that the uplands available, though, first of all, they were cheap to buy on a large scale. That was great for the Forestry Commission. But they were unsuitable for forestry, largely, because the soils were peaty, very wet. In some places where you had heather on top, it was too dry. You had very hard iron pans, you know, hard layers in the soil, which could not be broken with conventional agricultural plows. And there was no experience with cultivating such large areas economically. No one had done that before anywhere in the world, really. So the question is, how are we going to do this? How are we going to make these uplands suitable for forestry?
And these were the very same ancient environmental conditions that made the uplands unsuitable for those forests that you discovered at the bottom of the lake.
Well, not only, it's also human interference, because the hills of Scotland have been grazed over, well, hundreds of years, if not more, for more than a millennium, I mean, maybe even two millennia. So that plays also a part here, because the heather that we see in the Highlands is very suitable for sheep grazing. But the sheep grazing created its own environment. You know, the heather was burned on a regular basis, which leached the soil out and changed the properties of the soil. And yes, climate fluctuations play a role as well. When it got wetter, you got waterlogging, peat growth, which is not very good for trees. It kills off trees. So it's a combination of this human activity on the one hand and natural fluctuations on the other hand that made the Scottish uplands, in the long run, you can say, unsuitable for forestry.
So what practices did foresters adopt then to try and overcome these challenges?
They had to actually come up with completely new approaches to forestry. On the one hand, they had to find a tree or trees that could grow in these under these conditions. Another thing I forgot to mention is actually Scotland's extremely windy. The storms coming off the Atlantic are quite ferocious. It blows simply over trees. So you also must find ways to counter that as well. The other problem was the cultivation of the soils. They had to bring in nutrients. They had to break the impenetrable hard layers in the soil. And then they had to plant these trees on a large scale. So how did they go about it? Well, they realized from early on that plowing was the only way to cultivate these areas on a large scale. The problem was they didn't have plows that were suitable for plowing these areas. They were not strong enough to break the soil. The second problem was that fertilization on a large scale was not really possible in, say, 1920, because they didn't have helicopters who could do it. Another problem was that by hand, yes, you can cultivate the soil, but it's too labor intensive. So mechanical plowing became very, very important. But the tractors available at the time, in around 1920-25, were not strong enough to do it. So the Forestry Commission started to try plowing with horses. It was not very successful. And then the first trials with mechanical plowing were done in the 1930s, which proved quite promising. But it was only really after the Second World War that mechanical plowing took off in a big way, because, you know, Caterpillar tractors were developed really for the war effort. And they were strong enough to plow the land up. Also, plow technology itself, composite materials that could break iron pans, became available. And then you had the experimentation with trees, mainly Sitka spruce from the west coast of North America. And it turned out that this tree could withstand the very variable climatic conditions in Scotland. Wet soils, could also withstand slightly drier conditions. It was very good in windy places. And they also discovered that if you plant these trees in a very packed close together, they can stand wind throw very well, or withstand it, actually. But that was all things they had to find out, and it took about 25 to 30 years to do that.
And this is a point of the book that I found especially interesting. As someone who grew up in British Columbia, many of the trees that Scottish foresters transplanted to establish these forest reserves were trees that were common on the British Columbia landscape: Sitka spruce, Western red cedar, Douglas fir.
That's right. Yeah.
So is this a history of Scotland becoming British Columbia?
not entirely. I mean, some people complain about it, yes. It was more like Canada or Scandinavia than Scotland. But yeah.
Well, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the Foresters, their ideas, their attitudes toward the work that they were doing in the 20th century to create these forests. And how did those ideas change over time as they confronted this resistant environment?
When it started out in 1919, they got this mandate, create a large forestry reserve as fast as you can. And they knew it was going to be a challenge. But immediately, actually, the debate started of what do we want to do with these forests? Do we want to create something that is sustainable, that's the way we would call it today, you know, something for future generations, and also something that will resemble more of a forest ecosystem than a timber factory, where you just have monocultural plantations and nothing else? Or do we want something that is more diverse? And also, you know, if you plant monocultures, it is not very nice looking in the landscape. It's dark, it's you know, the geometric patterns, it's ugly. And that was something that was recognized by a lot of foresters as well. But on the other hand, you know, they had this mandate to create these forests, so they decided, okay, let's put these gripes to one side for now and let's create these forests. Once they there, we can start to, you know, to do something nice with it. And that's what I hoped for. But after the Second World War, actually, the planting effort was renewed and became even larger. At the same time, economic pressures were bearing down on them. They had to make forestry pay for itself, especially during the 1960s and 70s. So then they couldn't do, say, nice things with forests, make them more aesthetically pleasing, creating more diverse forestry ecosystems. So from the beginning, there was the feeling that forestry is not there just for the sake of timber production.
But the mandate was for timber production.
And that's right.
So that's really interesting to see that the foresters had sort of broader spectrum of perspective on the work that they were doing. They weren't just simply seeking to create a farm of trees, even though their mandate essentially was calling for that.
That's right, yes.
But since the 1970s, many of the assumptions of conservationists and foresters have been challenged by competing interests associated with nature preservation and tourism. Can you explain how popular attitudes toward Scottish forests have changed since the 1970s and what effect this has had on forestry policy?
Well, the interesting thing is that even by the 1950s, it was recognized that the forests that had been created were important for recreational purposes. So the Forestry Commission had already created national forest parks. The first was created actually before the Second World War, in 1936 in Argyll in the west of Scotland. But by 1960, car ownership was increasing rapidly. People were going out to see the landscape and enjoy it. And as they were confronted with these forestry plantations, and they didn't like them. They thought they were ugly. Especially English visitors to the Scottish landscape, they didn't like it because they were used to forests in, say, the Lake District, which is much more a lovely landscape, that's how it's described, you know, much more diverse and not these dark regimented forestry plantations. But the Forestry Commission realized that, and in the first half of the 1960s, they employed a forest or landscape architect to landscape their forests. So that was really enlightened to some extent. But on the other hand, in the most remote part, planting still continued on a large scale without regard of the landscape and any conservation issues that might arise. They were simply plowing up and sticking trees into the ground, or telegraph poles, as some people describe it. By the 1970s, the organizations like the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, the RSPB for short, they started to object to these policies of creating monocultural plantations and destroying the upland headlands and peatlands. They simply said, that's not good for birds. This all comes to a head by the early 1980s. When the RSPB, together with the Nature Conservancy, which was the government's conservation agency, really start to object to forest ploughing and the creation of monocultural forests from not only a perspective of birds, but also an ecological perspective. The Nature Conservancy is simply saying, we are destroying here large tracts of what we call blanket peat in the north of Scotland. They are unique environments. They are not found anywhere else in Europe or possibly anywhere else in the world, a unique species there, once you plow them up and stick trees in the ground, they will be gone forever. So we have to stop this. And they start, together with the RSPB, as well as some other conservation organizations, a campaign around 1982-83, which reaches a peak in 1986-87. It's a very public affair. You know, there are television programs made, there are articles appearing in the newspapers about a destruction of our, well, wet Serengeti. That's how it's described. It's a bit over
wet
the top,
Serengeti. Yeah.
Exactly. And foresters, actually, the forestry group is kind of flabbergasted. I mean, hang on, we believe in conservation and we believe that wildlife and diversity is important. But hang on, we are mandated to do this. You cannot make us the environmental villains of Britain.
And of course, the irony is the land that they were plowing and planting these trees on had, you know, when the commission began at in the 1920s was wasteland, was the cheaper land that no one wanted.
Exactly. That's right. So it's really ironic here that suddenly it's seen as valuable, but for completely different reasons.
But of course, the social and ecological values had changed by the 1970s and the 1980s.
By 1988, the Thatcher government is realizing that they couldn't go on like this. So it was decided to withdraw funding for forestry activities in the far north of Scotland completely. And that left the Forestry Commission actually with a financial problem, but also a problem of what is our mission? And they had to redefine themselves.
Well, by that time, had forestry not been, had gone into decline in terms of its contribution to the economic development of the region?
Well, the economic development, I mean, it was always portrayed as, oh, well, we have to make a huge contribution to the economy of the remote areas of Britain, but actually, looking at the data, it never contributed significantly to the economy of the remote areas of Britain. Maybe in the long run, it will contribute something because, you know, wood production is really coming online as we speak, actually. I mean, it takes, of course, 6, 7, 8 decades before you can start to harvest. So, but yeah, it's interesting that the attitudes totally changed in the 1990s. And
so how did the Forestry Commission respond to essentially getting the rug pulled out from underneath it?
Yeah, the Forestry Commission was looking at redefining what they were for, why they existed. And they did do this quite successfully because a lot of foresters that had been trained during the 1960s and 70s at Scottish and also English universities, they have been grounded more in things like ecology. And their approach to forestry and environmental issues was more holistic than their predecessors. So they were able to understand very well what the issues were. And they kind of could transform the Forestry Commission from within. So what you got was emphasis on things like planting of broadleaves, the preservation of what they call ancient woodlands, which are remnants of woods and forests that are older than 500 years, 500 years continuous forest cover without much human interference, and to preserve them for future generations. At the same time, they still say, okay, we have planted all these forests, so make good economic use of these forests, which means we harvest them when we can, but no clear felling. We do that very sensible so that it doesn't look ugly in the landscape. And recreation is also a very important part of forestry. Let's focus on that as well, because we can get revenue out of that as well, and it's to the benefit of the wider community. So they actually introduced kind of multi-purpose forestry, which looked at a whole wide spectrum of economic, social, and environmental values that have become important over the past 30 years.
And this, you say, brings an end to the monoculture forestry, which had been practiced for most of that period in the mid-20th century.
That's right, because planting, you know, totally crashes actually after about 1990, and at the moment it's very low, although the Scottish government wants to increase the area of forest and wood cover to 25%. It's about 18% now. You know, 25%, that target should be reached by 2050.
And would that primarily be for tourist purposes?
No, that will be for wood production.
Oh, okay.
So there's still something of the old ways around and the old thinking.
Yeah. Well, from a North American perspective, the book tells a really interesting story that in a lot of ways turns traditional environmental history narratives on its head. As I said, this is a history of afforestation, not a history of deforestation or even reforestation. So how do you see this history of Scottish afforestation fitting into global forest history? Was Scotland an outlier, or was it being influenced by transnational ideas of forestry practice?
Well, Scottish forestry was very clearly influenced by transnational networks of foresters and ecologists. And actually, that starts in the 19th century, because a lot of the ideas about modern forestry came from the colonial context, in particularly India, where a lot of Scottish trained foresters and botanists went into the colonial service and saw the work that was done there, got experience with a forestry authority which had been set up in 1864 already in India, the Indian Forest Service. And the ideas they picked up there about forestry, multipurpose forestry, looking at the environment, looking at the social context, was brought back to Scotland. And they advocated the creation of a forestry authority in the United Kingdom. They went into the lecture circuit. They were lobbying for the creation of forestry courses at the universities, and that was successful. And it also linked in with the desire of landowners to make better use of their estates. So, yeah, there's a clear transnational link here. They were part of this global network of naturalists, foresters, and ecologists, and the ideas that were floating around at the time.
Mm-hmm. So, and that seems to fit really closely with Canadian forest history, U.S. forest history. These foresters are traveling and speaking to one another, especially within the British Empire.
That's right. But I must add something else here, and that is I'm working actually at the moment on an edited volume about European state forestry, looking at the different countries and how state forestry developed there. And one of the things that we discovered there is that every forest history in every different country is unique. Yes, there are comparisons in, you know, objectives, but the way that policy is carried out, the way that the landscape is regarded and what forestry is doing to the landscape, it's unique in every single country. And Scotland is no exception. What happens there is quite unique, actually. And yes, there are similarities with, say, France, for example. We have afforestation programs of sandy areas in the southwest of the country. But the cultural background is so different that it's sometimes very hard to compare the two. But that makes it extremely interesting. That it's so diverse. And what is really needed is actually, and that's why we do this edited volume, we should bring together all these different histories and say, okay, how did they fit together? Why are they unique? And what are the similarities? And what can we learn from this diversity?
Do you think that the unique character of different state forestry programs might be related to the ecological conditions within those regions?
No, I don't think so. Because if you look at Northern Europe, and that's what we're talking about here in the context of this new edit volume that will come out hopefully sometime next year, is that the Scottish climate is quite similar, or the British climate in general, to other countries around the North Sea basin. And still, their forest histories are quite different. So the environment and the ecological conditions are not all defining. What seems to be more important here is the cultural and social background of all these different countries that result in different outcomes.
Well, I think anybody who's planning a trip to the Scottish uplands should probably pick up a copy of Conquering the Highlands, A History of the Afforestation of the Scottish Uplands. And anyone interested in world forest history should really take a look at this case study. Jan, thanks for telling us more about your book.
And thank you very much for hosting this edition of the podcast.
Jan's book, Conquering the Highlands, can be downloaded as a free ebook from the ANU ePress at epress.anu.edu.au. Just search for Conquering the Highlands. You can also purchase a print copy from Amazon. And if you're interested in checking out the book's companion website with interactive maps, source material, and oral histories that were used to write the book, the companion website is at scottish-forest-history.net. Please refer to the podcast page on the Environmental History Resources website for active links to these sites. We've come to the end of this episode, and we hope you enjoyed it. Next time, Jan will be back as host, and for now, it's goodbye from me. This is Sean Courage from Toronto.